Come now to oral questions. The first in the name of Joseph Mooney.
Mr. Speaker, my question is to the Minister of Finance. What recent reports has she seen on the New Zealand economy?
Mr. Speaker.
The Honourable Nicola Willis.
Last week, ANZ released its Business Outlook Report and its Consumer Confidence Report, both of which come out monthly. These show that consumer confidence continues to rise, albeit off a very low base. And business confidence is on a strong upward trend despite levelling out in February.
Supplementary. How does consumer and business confidence compare to previous years?
Mr. Speaker, in 2022 and 2023, consumer confidence fell to the lowest level ever reported in the survey, lower than the global financial crisis and lower than during the COVID lockdowns. And, strike me down, business confidence was also the lowest it has ever been in 2022 and 2023. Again, it was lower than in the global financial crisis and lower than during the COVID lockdowns. So, Mr. Speaker, it is very heartening indeed that consumer and business confidence is rising off the all-time lows recorded under the previous government.
Commentary. What do the results say about people's own expectations?
Mr. Speaker, the Consumer Confidence Survey shows that, in net terms, people expect that they and their family will be better off financially in a year's time. At present, people are wary about purchasing major household items, but this measure is on an upward trend and is considerably better than it was last year.
Supplementary. What do the results say about business expectations?
Mr. Speaker, the Business Outlook Survey saw lifts in most forward-looking indicators such as businesses' own activity, investment intentions, employment intentions and profit expectations. Together with the consumer results, this reinforces that New Zealanders are more optimistic about their future under this coalition government.
Question number two in the name of Mark Cameron.
Thank you, Mr. Speaker. My question is to the Associate Minister for the Environment. What is his most immediate priority in the portfolio?
Honourable Andrew Hogarth.
Mr. Speaker, thank you. My highest priority is delivering on the government's 100-day plan to begin stopping the implementation of new significant natural areas, known as SNAs. SNAs are an unjustified and unhelpful intrusion into private property rights and are getting in the way of productive farming. ACT's coalition agreement with National commits to stop the implementation of new SNAs and to review their operation. I have been working with officials and I intend to take a plan to Cabinet on the most effective way to do that.
Supplementary. What examples has he seen recently that highlights the challenge farmers and other landowners face from SNAs on their property?
Mr. Speaker, landowners have told me that if you're unlucky enough to have an SNA identified on your property, you are likely to be prohibited from undertaking any new activity or development in that area. I have also seen that these restrictions will be applied to areas that are not very significant. For example, a sheltered gully with some trees, a bit of matagari, which offers a great sheltered area to graze a few sheep after shearing or in a storm.
What is the effect of those restrictions?
Mr. Speaker, apart from being a disincentive to voluntarily conserve areas of Indigenous biodiversity, farmers know well what happens when the ability to actively manage land is restricted. If SNAs are applied to areas with low biodiversity value, then without the landowner managing pest and weed control, it will just go to gorse, broom and wilding pines.
What will he do in the long term to restore property rights and protect Indigenous biodiversity?
Mr. Speaker, it is good. Landowners are already voluntarily protecting areas of native biodiversity. Over 180,000 hectares are already protected through QE2 National Trust. Put together, that would be our fifth largest national park, all voluntarily. Many more have committed to enhance biodiversity on their land without formalising it. The way to protect biodiversity on private land is to work collaboratively with landowners, including farmers, foresters and iwi, to incentivise the sustainable use of land and to show them that their work to protect biodiversity is valued, and then they will want to do more.
The Honourable Damien O'Connor.
Supplementary. Mr Speaker, to the member, is he aware of the EU's requirement to prove that there is no deforestation taking place in areas that are supplying the EU market, and that, in fact, the protection of SNAs will assist farmers to access that high-value market?
Andrew Hogan.
Yes, I am aware of that clause in the ETA, and what I would say and point to is the fact that there is already, sorry, the EU Free Trade Agreement, but there is already a great number, as I pointed out, of farmers who are voluntarily protecting biodiversity. When I go and visit farms and I see farmers now, they are taking massive pride in the work they are doing on their farm. We will work collaboratively with them to enhance that effort and to do more.
Speaker.
Point of order.
Point of order, Honourable Carmel Cipollone.
Mr Speaker, my question is next. Seemed that supplementary questions were over. I'm speaking to the Speaker's ruling 170-4, which is ministers not only have a right to determine which of them is the appropriate minister to answer a question, they also have a duty to the House to decide on the appropriate minister to answer. Mr Speaker, the question I put up today, which is question three, was initially put forward to the Minister for Social Development and is with respect to the MSD emergency housing grants. It has been transferred to the Minister for Social Housing. However, it is the Minister for Social Development that has responsibility for the grant.
Okay. Well, I want a rule.
Speaking to the point of order.
The Honourable Chris Bishop.
The member makes a good point. But the member may also have missed what I said in the House yesterday, which is that this government has taken a decision to make the housing-related functions relating to emergency housing the responsibility of the housing portfolio. Those functions have been delegated to the Associate Minister of Housing, Minister Potaka, which is why the question has been transferred into the housing domain. I appreciate that's a difference from the past, but that's been a deliberate policy decision.
I'll hear from the right on Winston Peters.
Mr Speaker, you're dealing with a point of order before the end of question time with respect to question two. And so why did you take that point of order when we still hadn't got rid of the sub-minutes for the second question? It's just not the order of business.
That's right, but we're doing it anyway. So, Ricardo, can you as much? Here we are. No, don't argue. Are you
speaking to the point of order?
Is it the same point of order or not?
It's speaking to the point of order, yes.
Well, it better be new stuff because I'm ready to give the ruling on this.
Okay. So just responding to what Mr Bishop said, there's a difference between the housing side of the emergency housing and what MSD frontline staff
are responsible for. That's not a point of order. I spoke the other day about the need for people to be specific about which point of order they're speaking to. That is not speaking to a point of order. It's offering an opinion.
Just ruling 1704. And
don't interfere when someone is taking a point of order. The House is silent. Now, just say to Mr. Menendez March, this is something that I am ready to rule on. So make his point, make it succinct if he wants to, but we will be moving on beyond that.
So I'll make it succinct. MSD frontline staff have a direct responsibility to the delivery of emergency housing grants. Therefore, the responsibility on both questions 3 and 6 sit within the Minister of Social Development.
Offbeat again, because if anyone reads Speaker's rulings from about 170 right through to 174, there are numerous recommendations from multiple speakers that make it clear that it is the government's choice as to who answers the question, not the speaker's. If I refer particularly to 1741, it makes it clear that only in very exceptional circumstances would the speaker interfere, and I don't intend upending those previous rulings. We move now to question number 2, in the name of the Honourable Carmel Cipollone.
Order, sir.
Point of order.
I accept that ruling, and I accept the explanation given by the Leader of the House. But it is on the basis of both that I raise this point of order. is that if on that basis questions are transferred to the Honourable Tama Pōtaka, I find it interesting, therefore, that my question, which was originally posed to him, has been transferred to Chris Bishop. I refer to Speaker's ruling 1735. If the Leader of the House, the Minister of Housing, has said that all responsibility regarding emergency housing, social housing, has been delegated to Tama Pōtaka, I don't believe that there is justification to then transfer my question, which relates solely to that, to the Honourable Chris Bishop.
Well, 1735 doesn't quite get to that point, but...
Speaking of the point of order. The question on the Mr McInulty's question has been transferred to me because, and I appreciate that he may not have read the delegations, but the question of funding for IRRS places and the structure and funding of the appropriations for vote housing within my delegation, the delegations make it clear that the social and emergency housing delegation sits with Minister Pōtaka. We have actually clarified what was a frankly pretty messy situation before.
Thank you. Move to question number two in the name of the Honourable Carmel Cipollone.
Mr Speaker, my question is then to the Minister for Associate Minister Housing, Social Housing. Will his government's new approach to emergency housing grants result in more New Zealanders living on the streets?
Yes, the government's new approach is part of the wide response to end large-scale use of emergency housing and to get New Zealanders, tamariki and whānau, into homes faster.
Mr Speaker, supplementary question. Has he received advice or evidence showing that New Zealanders who will no longer be able to access emergency housing special needs grants under this government's new approach will all find housing and not end up living on the streets?
Te maunga o te whare. We receive advice on housing matters on a regular basis, and the advice that we've received is that we will continue to focus on ending the large-scale use of emergency housing and getting whānau and tamariki into homes faster.
Supplementary question. Does he agree with the previous Minister for Social Development and Social Housing who introduced the Emergency Housing Special Needs Grant, Paula Bennett, who stated, "This is the first time any government has committed ongoing dedicated funding for emergency housing because we recognise that not everyone has access to a safe and stable home"? If yes, why is he looking to reduce access to that support and push more New Zealanders back to sleeping in cars?
Te maunga o te whare. We recognise that there are many people with genuine needs that need emergency housing, and we will continue to support those people with genuine needs to have emergency housing accommodation.
Supplementary, the Right Honourable Winston Peters.
Can I ask the Minister as to whether or not he's received any reports that says his task now to solve this problem has been massively exacerbated by bringing in 148,000 immigrants as at December last year?
No, it's, look, we've got to stop doing this. It's not a fair question because it is not his responsibility. His responsibility is for emergency housing. Well, okay, I probably didn't pick that up. So the Minister may answer.
I've not received any reports on that in that respect, but there is a serious need and genuine needs amongst some whānau and tamariki to have emergency housing.
Supplementary question. Is it now this government's strategy to make it harder to access emergency housing grants so as to reduce the number of New Zealanders in emergency housing on their books, at the expense of more New Zealanders sleeping rough outside our businesses, in our car parks and in our parks?
It's maunga o te whare. We need bold and radical solutions to end the housing crisis that has been exacerbated under the previous government. We need to get the country back on track, in particular with housing, and we will do that through a wide series of responses and steps, one of which is prioritising the tamariki and whānau who have been sleeping in an emergency accommodation for 12 consecutive weeks or more.
Supplementary question. Does he agree with the Minister for Social Development and Employment that...
Stop. Your own side is speaking across the House while you're trying to ask a question. Please don't do it.
supplementary. Does he agree with the Minister for Social Development and Employment that, quote, I'm not saying it is going to be perfect. What I am saying is that we will have fewer children in motels, and that is what we are out to achieve, end quote. And if so, is living on the streets more perfect than living in a motel?
It's a mangonga whare. I agree with my learned colleague, the Minister of Social Development, member for Taupo, in that we do need absolute radical and bold solutions for our housing crisis. And it is tough for those folks, and no one in this House wants to see whānau, tamariki and mokopuna living in emergency housing for an extended period of time. But that is what we have seen over the last 6 years.
Supplementary question. Will we see homelessness situations like that of West Auckland tetraplegic woman Tracy Penny, who was living in her van in January 2017, which was widely reported on, arise again because of the changes to the treatment of homeless MSD clients?
It's a mangonga whare. Can I please reiterate that we will support those with genuine need to have emergency housing, but our aspiration is to end the large-scale use of emergency housing, particularly in places like Hamilton and Waikato, where there are over 500 kids living in emergency housing right now.
Question number four, in the name of David McLeod.
Thank you, Mr. Speaker. My question is to the Minister responsible for RMA reform, and asks, what announcements has he made regarding the establishment of a new fast-track consenting one-stop-shop regime?
Honourable Chris Bishop.
Mr. Speaker, earlier today, alongside the Prime Minister and the Minister for Regional Development and the Minister of Transport, I announced the Coalition Government's new one-stop-shop fast-track approvals regime. And this afternoon, the House will consider that legislation in its first reading. Mr. Speaker, that New Zealand has been stuck in the slow lane for far too long when it comes to getting the major projects we need to get our country growing again. We are determined to cut through the thicket of red and green tape holding New Zealand back by fast-tracking consents for projects of regional and national significance whilst protecting treaty settlements and the environment.
Supplementary, how will projects be fast-tracked under the new regime?
Oh, very good question. Mr. Speaker, there are two ways projects can be fast-tracked. They can either be referred by the joint decision of the Ministers of Infrastructure, Regional Development and Transport upon an application, or by being listed in Schedule 2A of the bill. Projects in Schedule 2A will be automatically referred into the fast-track process. And just on Mr. Robertson's point, the bill does not currently contain any projects listed in Schedule 2A. The government will be setting up a thorough and transparent process, a fast-track advisory group of independent experts to provide advice to ministers on what projects should be included. And in the coming weeks, we will appoint the group, publish the criteria, and ministers and the cabinet will receive advice on those projects.
Supplementary.
No, just wait.
How will the environment...
No, just wait a moment.
Sorry. There How will the environment and treaty settlements be protected under the new legislation?
Well, Mr. Speaker, all of the projects... Well, that was actually the question, and if you give me a chance, I'll answer it. Mr. Speaker, all the projects considered under the new fast-track regime will be considered by an expert panel. And, of course, the expert panel process is not a new one, because that process was set up by the last government when it came to their own COVID-19 fast-track regime. That expert panel will apply relevant consent and permit conditions. Panels will have a maximum of 6 months to do so. The projects will then be sent back to joint ministers to either approve it or decline it, and they'll be able to refer the project back to the panel if the consent conditions are too onerous. The bill contains extensive protections around treaty settlements and the environment. But we also must make it... I've just answered the question about the treaty. You really need to listen. But we also must make it clear to the world, Mr. Speaker, that New Zealand is open for business once again and build a pipeline of projects to grow the economy and improve our productivity. And today's announcement is a step towards that.
Fairly long answer. Question number five, in the name of the Honourable Willie Jackson.
Mr. Speaker, to the Minister of Media and Communications, does she stand by all her statements and actions?
Yes.
Mr. Speaker, to the Minister, what actions, if any, has she taken to support the media sector in light of job losses at News Hub and Television New Zealand?
Mr. Speaker, the government is committed to working with the sector on ways to ensure sustainability. As I have previously stated, the Fair Digital News Bargaining Bill is currently before Select Committee, and I'm awaiting the committee's report. I'm working with officials to modernise the media system in New Zealand to level the playing field for our local broadcasters. I want to encourage more private and international investment in our local content.
Supplementary, Reuben Davidson.
To the Minister. Does she agree with the comment of David Seymour that, quote, these are the people that cry, oh, you've got to give us sympathy and you're inhumane and you should be kinder to us, close quote, and if not, why not?
Mr. Speaker, Honourable David Seymour has his own views and he is responsible for his comments. As a shareholding minister, it will be irresponsible for me to interfere in TVNZ's editorial independence. I believe and honour TVNZ's editorial independence. The media perform an important duty in our democracy, and this should be protected. What I think we should be focusing on is the people who are facing uncertainty over their jobs and livelihoods and not squabbling over he said, she said. It is ironic to actually get this question from that member, considering his colleague, when as minister, was making comments about a presenter on Q&A.
Mr. Speaker, does the minister think singling out reporters for doing their job is appropriate? And if so, has she spoken with David Seymour about respecting the independence of the full staff?
If you don't mind,
sorry,
when I ask you to stop, please stop.
Oh, now, sorry, madam. Sorry, Mr. Speaker. Throw him out, Mr. Speaker.
Wait on. It's not far off. I mean, you've got to, if we're having a rule, and we are, that questions are asked in silence, observe it. Contain yourselves with perhaps a deep breath and holding till the end of it, something like that. But we're not going to have those sort of outbursts in the middle of questions. Start again.
Thank you, Mr. Speaker. Mr. Speaker,
yes.
Does the minister believe singling out reporters for doing their job is appropriate? And has she spoken with David Seymour, who is one of the senior ministers, Mr. Speaker, about respecting the independence of the Fourth Estate?
Honourable Minister Lee.
Mr. Speaker, I believe and honour all editorial independence of our media because they perform an important duty in our democracy and that should be protected. In terms of the comment, I think, as I said previously, it is ironic to watch this member ask this question given his previous interview on Q&A.
A point of order.
Mr. Speaker, we're talking about a shareholding minister here. We're not talking about me when I was a previous minister. The question is very relevant. Can you ask this minister to answer or address the question?
Well, most certainly the question is being addressed. How it's being addressed may not find favour with everyone in the House, but it is also rife within Speaker's rulings that it is not unreasonable for ministers of a successive government to point out situations that existed in a previous government. It's the attack aspect that's the problem. Carry on.
Point of order,
the Honourable Simeon Brown.
For a member to be able to ask the question again.
You can't seek leave. Can I just say that is very disorderly. You cannot seek leave for another member, and that member does know that's the case.
Mr. Honourable Kieran McAnulty. Thank you, Mr. Speaker.
In silence.
regardless of whether you agreed with the point of order made by Honourable Willie Jackson or not, throughout that, there was the exact response that you asked the government not to do whilst questions were being asked. And if we're going to require points of orders to be heard in silence, they should be made to be heard in silence.
Good point.
Thank you.
The Honourable Melissa Lee. Have you finished your answer?
Yes, I have.
You've got another sub?
Speaker, Mr. Speaker, what impression does the Minister think does she give out to those who will be losing their jobs at Television New Zealand and News Hub, that at the exact time she was refusing to do media, Mr. Speaker, she was attending a luxury resort on the taxpayers' dollar, Mr. Speaker? What is the impression she gives out to the public and to all the poor people who've been losing their jobs, Mr. Speaker? And here's this beautiful photo for everyone
to
have a look at. What was the impression, Mr. Speaker, that she's giving out to the public?
The Honourable Melissa Lee. That's enough. You've gone way over the top.
That is the substance of the previous government. That member does not even know that that photo was taken at the New Zealand Open, and I was there as the minister responsible funding major events fund. However, at the time when the announcement was made this morning, I was in my office doing work. But yesterday, I did not actually see the announcement alert that actually came to my office because I was doing an interview with one of the media companies.
Point of order again, Mr. Speaker. The question is clear. What impression is she giving to the public when she should have been doing her job
and
giving a response?
Mr. Jackson, I'm sorry. The problem here is that your point of order has been refuted in its content by the minister. Your question, refuted in its content by the minister. So there is no further action to be taken. Do you have another supplementary? No. Then in that case... In that case, we move to question number 6 in the name of Ricardo Mendes-March.
Thank you, Mr. Speaker. My question is to the Associate Minister of Housing, Social Housing. Can he guarantee that the increased scrutiny on emergency housing eligibility he announced yesterday won't lead to more people becoming homeless?
The Honourable Tamapotika.
E oati ana au ki tēnei whare rangatira nei. E ngana ana te kāwanatanga haumi me au nei, ao pō ao, kia puta ngā tangata me ngā whānau me ngā tamariki e noho ana ki rotu ngā whare ohotata ki ō rātou kāinga ake. E mihi ana.
What is the purpose of asking someone living below the poverty line who can't afford a private rental to look for unaffordable housing while waiting for secure, affordable public housing?
It's among all to whare. As mentioned earlier today, we need bold and radical solutions for our housing crisis, and we are absolutely committed to end the large-scale use of emergency housing and to help whānau and tamariki in particular get into homes faster.
If he can't guarantee that his policies won't leave more people in the streets and without safe shelter, why is he going ahead with them?
It's among oil to whare. As mentioned earlier, we're absolutely focused on ending the large-scale use of emergency housing, and there will be some engaging and tough decisions and considerations for officials to make. However, we intend to end large-scale emergency housing, which has been absolutely exacerbated by the previous government.
Is he not able to guarantee that his policies will lead to more people being homeless? Because the policies will actually create more reasons for frontline MSD staff to deny special needs grants to enable people to be in emergency housing.
What I can guarantee is that this government myself...
Rephrase that. That's not a question. That's a statement of opinion. And we've had a discussion about that already this week. Ask a question.
can he guarantee the public that there will be no increases or incidents of people becoming homeless as a direct result of the increased ability of frontline MSD staff to deny people special needs grants for them to access emergency housing?
It's Māngaro Tawhiti. I can guarantee that this government is committed to get New Zealanders, tamariki and whānau out of emergency housing and into homes faster. And I can also guarantee that our officials will work hard to ensure that whānau do not end up in emergency housing and end up into alternative housing before they get there.
Come to question number 7 in the name of Debbie Nauruwapaka.
Tēnā koe te pika. My question is to the Prime Minister. Does he stand by his government's policies and actions?
Right Honourable Winston Peters.
Yes.
Supplementary. What implications will the exclusion of a treaty clause from fast-tracking legislation have on Māori fundamental rights and interests in resource consents, especially for hapū and iwi who have not settled yet?
The fact is that that exclusion will have a very positive outcome for Māori, because now things will be based on merit and not just elitism and racism, which ordinary Māori never asked for in the first place.
Supplementary. What qualifies a project as having significant regional or national benefits, and how are these economic benefits weighted against environmental costs?
All aspects for consideration will be very jealously guarded in terms of the research on them. They'll go through a serious process of examination, but we're a country that needs to get our mojo back and real fast and not have certain elitists stopping every project that we should be developing. We've got the resources, we've got the people, we just need and now have got the leadership.
Just wait for the quiet. Thank you.
Supplementary. How much money will be set aside to mitigate risks of failed fast-track projects, such as we saw with Tamarind Taranaki Oil Project, which cost the government hundreds of millions of dollars in bailout?
Exaggeration.
Certain expenditure is always warranted. Certain expenditure is always warranted, but none of it will amount to the $1.2 billion that vanished on Three Waters.
Come now to question number 8, in the name of the Honourable Kieran McAnulty.
Thank you, Mr. Speaker. To the Minister of Housing, how many additional social houses will be created as a result of the Priority 1 category for emergency housing announced yesterday?
Honourable Chris Bishop.
Mr. Speaker, the government's creation of the Priority 1 category will prioritise getting families with children out of emergency housing into stable social housing sooner. Therefore, more social housing is not created directly as a result of this policy change. We've committed through our manifesto to increase the number of social housing places in line with the previous government's funding track. The member will note that the previous government left a fiscal cliff of funding for social housing, so any future funding is subject to budget decisions. The Priority 1 category is only the beginning of the steps we will be taking to end the large-scale use of emergency housing, motels, and returning them to really and briefly needed as a last resort. Addressing the issue of emergency housing is complex, and as I said yesterday, Mr. Speaker, will require a sustained and coordinated effort over multiple years to achieve our aim. But the key thing is we're not going to sit by, like the last government did, and ignore it. We are taking action.
Point of order.
Point of order, the Honourable Kieran McAnulty.
That was a reasonably straight question. It was a question on notice. I'm sure it wouldn't have been accepted if it wasn't a straight question. But throughout that response from the Minister, it was attacking the previous government, which you have ruled yourself is inappropriate.
I have, but when I've said that, it's if the question is opens with an attack, but if it's used as a comparison between two positions, standing orders, Speaker's rulings are very clear that that is permissible. So I'll keep a listen out. I think there was some language used in there, like fiscal cliff, that was probably unacceptable, but I'm sure that the next question will be better answered.
Supplementary. Why then did the government make an emergency housing announcement without committing to funding more additional social housing?
Well, for a couple of reasons. One is that you don't need to do both things at the same time. The second point is that not everyone who goes from emergency housing goes into social housing. Actually, the housing system is extremely complex. The relationships between emergency housing, social housing, and transitional are actually not linear. We see private landlords and the wider housing system as a part of the solution, and work is underway across every part of the housing continuum, from home ownership through to the rental market, through to the private landlord market, through to social housing generally.
Supplementary. If they can't stay in emergency housing and the government won't commit to funding more social housing, transitional housing or rental places, where are they supposed to go?
Well, the member's question is based upon a false assumption. There is more social housing coming. The budget 2023 increased social housing places by 3,000. That goes on top of budget 2022. So between now and June, well, by between the 18 months ago and 2 years, up until June 2025, there are 6,000 new social housing places, delivered both by Kāinga Ora and by the community housing sector. So there are more social housing places. Decisions around future social housing funding is a matter for the budget. The member will have to wait.
Point of order.
Point of order.
The previous question, the minister referred to additional social housing. I too have used the words additional and more. By virtue of that, it is on top of what has already been committed. All the minister just outlined are social houses that were funded by the previous government, and I'm asking him about his commitment that he stated in his answer to funding additional social houses. It's not appropriate, I believe, for the minister to point to things that are happening, particularly when it wasn't him that established those.
Well, I'll let you go right through that point of order, because essentially you were making a point that is outside of standing orders as such, but the answer that I heard is that relates to the date 2025, where there are more social housing. That's still at least 18 months off, and through one more budget period. So I think the claim is not right, and nor is the point of order.
Supplementary. Will he guarantee to the House that his government will not sell off social houses like what happened the last time National were in government?
You did it. We
just wait for colleagues to finish.
No, just dance.
The previous government sold social houses. So let's just be really clear about this. The last Labor government sold social houses, and the policy settings that Kāinga Ora was operating under in relation to the difference between the 2008 period and the 2017 period did not change after the Labor government was elected. It is true that the National government from 2008 to 2017, which, by the way, I'm not responsible for, but I'm happy to comment extensively on, transferred ownership of some social housing in Tauranga to accessible properties. Here's the thing. The people living in the houses were social housing tenants. It's just that the government did not happen to own the underlying house. And actually, on this side of the house, we are relatively agnostic about who provides housing to people in need. Unlike the last government, we do not have an obsession with the idea that the government should do everything in housing. Right. We back communities, we back the private sector, and we back housing for Kiwis.
Supplementary, Honourable Kira McNulty.
Supplementary, if the minister is unwilling to provide that guarantee, will he at least guarantee to the House that levels of homelessness will not increase as a result of the announcement made yesterday?
The fastest way to increase homelessness would have been for the government to continue with the funding track we inherited, which would have seen 10,000 state houses sold off by Kāinga Ora because of that member's party's woeful mismanagement of one of the biggest companies in New Zealand. Under the funding track we inherited, in writing, Kāinga Ora was planning to sell 10,000 state houses. We're not prepared to sit around and tolerate that. That's why we're reviewing Kāinga Ora.
Supplementary.
The Honourable Kira McAnulty.
If homelessness goes up under his watch, will he resign?
I plan on being a better minister responsible for homelessness than the last one, the Honourable Marama Davidson, who saw homelessness skyrocket to record levels and couldn't even spend the money that Megan Woods allocated to her.
Question number nine, in the name of Carl Bates.
Thank you, Mr. Speaker. And my question is to the Minister of Transport and asks, what recent announcements has he made about transport investment in New Zealand?
Honourable Simeon Brown.
Thank you, Mr. Speaker. Earlier this week, the Prime Minister and I released the draft government policy statement on land transport, announcing that we are focused on investing in new roads of national significance, better public transport and a well-maintained roading network, enabling Kiwis to get where they want to go quickly and safely. Kiwis around the country voted for our focused transport plan, and now we are delivering.
Supplementary. What does the government policy statement mean for Auckland?
Oh, good question. Well, 57.8% of Aucklanders voted for the coalition government at the last election, and our draft GPS prioritises the projects that we campaigned on. Mill Road, a project that the Member of Parliament campaigned on very, very hard. The East-West Link and the Northwestern Alternative State Highway are listed as new roads of national significance. While Auckland's infrastructure deficit has worsened in recent years due to project cancellations and non-delivery by the prior government, our government is focused on delivery.
Supplementary.
Cameron.
What does the government policy statement mean?
You're not called yet. Now you stand up. It's Cameron Broad.
Supplementary. What does the government policy statement mean for the public transport users in northwest Auckland?
Oh, very good news. Very good news, Mr. Speaker. It's great news. The government is investing up to $4.4 billion on public transport infrastructure and services. We're focused on starting work on the northwest rapid transit corridor to unlock housing and economic growth in Auckland's northwest. We have a strong track record of delivering better public transport in Auckland, the City Rail Link case in point, and we will continue this legacy.
Supplementary.
Paulo Garcia.
What progress has been made on the government's 100-day plan commitment to axe the Auckland regional tax, fuel tax?
Oh, well, Mr. Speaker, very good news. That last night, the government passed legislation to axe the 11.5 cents per litre fuel tax for Aucklanders. We're not a government that will continue to tax Aucklanders to fund cycle lanes, expensive speed bumps and blanket speed limit reductions. This tax is gone on the 1st of July.
Mr. Speaker. Stuart Smith.
Thank you, Mr. Speaker. What does the government policy statement mean for the top of the South?
Oh, Mr. Speaker. In addition to the Woodend Bypass, a second Ashburton Bridge and investment in critically important bridges in the South Island, we have listed the Hope Bypass in the South Island as a new road of national significance. This project, paired with a new $500 million pothole prevention fund, will allow motorists in the top of the South get where they need to go quickly and safely.
Good. We come now to question number 10, in the name of the Honourable Rachel Brooking.
Thank you, Mr. Speaker. My question is to the Minister responsible for RMA reform. Does he stand by all his statements and actions?
Honourable Christopher Bishop.
Yes.
Supplementary. Why should economic ministers decide what is worthy of proceeding rather than an expert panel, as suggested in the new fast-tracking legislation?
Knowledge and talent.
Because the whole purpose of the fast-track consenting regime that we are introducing is to fast-track economic development projects.
Will the projects yet to be included in Schedule 2A and 2B of the proposed bill be referred to Select Committee for scrutiny, including the ability for the public to submit?
No, that's not the intention. Instead, what we're doing is running a process that is independent of the government. Recommendations will come to ministers. The projects will then be inserted into the bill via either in an amendment paper, or it used to be called a supplementary order paper, and there'll be plenty of opportunities for the public to engage on that, and I look forward to that.
How will the public be able to engage in the process he just referred to?
Well, it's a public democratic process. People who are keen on having the projects inserted into the bill will be able to submit them to the expert panel that we're setting up to consider those projects.
Supplementary. Why is the Minister for the Environment not involved in the decision-making process when the Ministers of Infrastructure, Regional Development and Transport are?
Because, as I say, this is a one-stop shop, fast-track consenting regime specifically designed to accelerate infrastructure, housing, transport, aquaculture, mining, the extractive industries, all of the things that New Zealand needs more of rather than less of, and the relevant environmental considerations are best handled by the expert panel. They're the experts for it. They're going to be asked to apply the relevant environmental permits and conditions to it, and then those decisions will come back through the process for ministers to either approve or decline. It's not actually wildly dissimilar to the COVID-19 fast-track legislation set up by the previous government. We've actually, Mr Speaker, modelled the new law on the old regime introduced by the last Labor government. We thought it was such a good idea, we've taken it the next step further, elevated it up a bit, and gone for national and regionally significant projects. And I thank the former minister and the former Minister for the Environment for the idea.
That's good. Just keep those answers fairly succinct.
Supplementary.
Are you asking supplementary?
Yes.
The Honourable Simeon Brown.
Is the Minister aware of any work done by the prior government to put forward legislation for exceptions to the Otago Regional Water Plan, National Policy Statements for Freshwater Management, Public Works Act, in regards to Lake Onslow?
Sorry, when I say stop there, if members don't, then their time in the House will not be very long at all. Are there any other supplementaries on this? We go for question number 11, the name of Rima Nuckley.
My question is to the Minister of Justice and asks, how is the government progressing its commitments in relation to restoring law and order?
Honourable Goldsmith. Yeah. Thank you. Paul Goldsmith.
Thank you, Mr Speaker. On Tuesday, we introduced and have now passed legislation to stop taxpayer funding of Section 27 cultural reports that proliferated under the former regime, consuming more than $7 million out of the legal aid budget. Yesterday, we introduced legislation to give police greater powers to search for firearms so that they can keep them out of the hands of serious gang offenders and help keep our communities safe. And today, we will be introducing legislation to give police greater powers to deal with gangs who, for too long, have been allowed to behave as if they're above the law.
Supplementary. What is the legislation that the government is introducing today going to do?
Well, Mr Speaker, the gangs legislation amendment bill does four things. We're prohibiting the display of gang insignia in all public places. We're giving the police the ability to require gang members to disperse from gatherings that disrupt the public, creating new non-consorting orders to stop specified gang members from associating, and finally we're amending the Sentencing Act to make gang membership on its own an aggravating factor at sentencing.
Supplementary.
A small question. So you're asking that question about a bill that's being introduced today. There were no bills introduced today, so timing is not very tidy on this one. There may be a different way to ask some subsequent supplementaries. Can I call a Honourable Duncan Webb?
Mr Speaker, point of order. Just in light of that ruling, Mr Speaker, the member appeared to be quoting from an official document, i.e. the bill, and I'd invite him to table it.
No, you can't invite him to table it. I can ask him if he's quoting from an official document.
not.
No, that's something you can speculate on, not ask about. Dr.
Parliamentary.
Dr. Duncan Webb.
Thank you, Mr. Speaker. Why is the Minister pushing his wasteful gang insignia ban when his own department and the Chief Science Advisor has said a challenge of the suppression strategy is that there is no strong evidence it works to reduce long-term offending behaviours or eliminate gangs? It's science.
Why? Because we don't agree with that analysis, and actually we're seeing a 50% increase in gang membership under the previous government, and we want to stop that because we believe that law-abiding citizens should be going about their business without being intimidated by gangs.
Rima Nakhali.
Supplementary. Wow. Why is the government doing this now?
Because the gangs, Mr. Speaker, have been recruiting faster than the police over the past 6 years, from 6,000 odd in 2018 to 9,000 at present, a 50% increase. They've been emboldened to take over public places and to continue to be associated with crime. That is why a firmer response is required now.
Supplementary.
Rima Nakhali.
How many actions relating to restoring law and order in the 100-day plan has the government completed?
Well, Mr. Speaker, the government is committed to a number of immediate actions in the 100-day plan, from stopping taxpayer funding for Section 27 reports, to abolishing the previous government's prisoner reduction target, to taking the first steps to ensure prisoners on remand can access rehabilitation programs, and many other things that my colleagues, Ministers Mitchell, McKee and Chua, have progressed, and the first reading of the gangs legislation bill and courts amendment bill today rounds out the 100-day plan.
Well, point of order.
Dr. Duncan Webb, point of order.
The question was how many, and the Minister didn't answer it.
Well, it's a little unusual for the opposition to be worried about a government question not being answered, but the Minister might like to address that.
I think the member can count for himself.
Only question.
Supplementary question.
Could I ask the Minister as to whether he's received reports that suggest he should listen to real evidence, such as coming out of Western Australia, where they have tried exactly what we're doing here now, as against this academic trivia that is taken as being evidence in this country now?
Indeed, I listen to a wide range of evidence. And one, of course, of the strongest issues around gang and signature has been the success of the previous bill introduced by the Honourable Todd McClay, which banned gang patches from schools and hospitals and public buildings, which has been very successful.
The Honourable Dr. Duncan Webb.
Why is he pressing on with his insignia ban, given the advice he received from the Ministry of Justice that the reduction in visibility of gangs experienced by Queensland and Western Australia is simply the product of gangs relocating to other jurisdictions that impose fewer restrictions? And New Zealand's... And New Zealand's unitary nature means there is no alternate jurisdiction to which gangs can relocate.
Well, of course, Mr. Speaker, we'd be happy if the gangs relocated somewhere else and cleared out of this country and left our people alone.
Honourable Nicole McKee.
What law and order actions has this government committed to beyond the 100-day plan to protect small business owners from retail crime?
Well, I thank the member for that question. Retail crime has indeed exploded in the previous 6 years, with reported victims of retail crime up by 110%. The government's committed to restoring real consequences for crime, which is why, as part of the Coalition Agreement with the Act and supported by New Zealand First, we've committed to adding additional aggravating factors during sentencing where the victim is working solo or adjacent to the dwelling. This will add further protections to small business owners from retail crime and is amongst the many of the steps we have taken to rebuild confidence in the justice system and to restore law and order.
Dr. Duncan Webb.
Why is the Minister pushing non-consorting laws rather than following reliable Australian evidence, such as the New South Wales Ombudsman's 2016 review of its anti-consorting laws, which found they required significant use of police resources without a clear benefit to the public interest?
Why? Because we think it's important to give the police extra tools to deal with gangs in this country, given that over the last 5 years there's been a 50% increase in gang activity. And it's time that we had some extra tools to help the police do their job and keep our communities safe.
Reverend Oakley.
Chair, supplement. Does the Minister consider it acceptable to disagree with advice from his officials?
Well, yes, I do from time to time. We don't necessarily agree with every piece of advice that we get from officials here in Wellington. And we treat all advice with respect. But fundamentally, when a government is elected to deliver on a policy to keep our country safe, we will deliver on that policy, Mr. Speaker.
Question number 12, in the name of the Honourable James Shaw.
Yeah, thank you, Mr. Speaker. My question is to the Minister responsible for RMA reform. Does he stand by all of his statements and policies?
The Honourable Chris Bishop.
Yes.
Does he stand by his statement with regard to the Fast Track Bill, quote, "I want a thorough and transparent process," end quote?
Yes.
Huh. How does introducing legislation with such extraordinary ministerial powers under urgency, less than an hour before it is due to be debated into the House, with two critical schedules withheld from public scrutiny, meet the standard of, quote, thorough and transparent?
Well, Mr. Speaker, how do I count the ways? Firstly, the government announced that we were doing this back in late January, early February. I made that a public announcement and we published the framework and the design of this scheme. That went out to all and sundry, iwi, post-government settlement entities, environmental NGOs who've been voluminous in their criticism of it, but we'll take that as read. The public has had many chances to engage on this. Officials have been working away, designing the bill. The bill has been introduced, albeit, yes, under urgency, to meet the 100-day commitment to get into the House. And the reason why it's under urgency is to send it to a committee as soon as possible so the public can have their say on this extremely important piece of legislation. And there are a number of other examples that I could point to.
How can he justify limiting public consultation when projects that are on the secret schedule could include coal mines, deep sea mines, and projects that have already been turned down by the courts?
You refer to a secret schedule. We heard earlier in the day there's nothing on the schedule, so don't use language like that.
How can he justify limiting public consultation when projects that will be on the schedule could include coal mines, deep sea mines, and projects that have already been turned down by the courts on environmental grounds, whilst overriding protections for freshwater and Indigenous biodiversity?
Oh, I justify it in the same way that the previous government introduced the COVID-19 fast track regime, which included 17 or maybe 19 projects listed in the schedule that were automatically referred to an expert panel. That member was a member of the government that supported that regime in the last parliament. It's very similar. Actually, we've been even more transparent in the sense that we are running an independent process for projects to be referred to the government to insert in the bill. In the last parliament, the COVID-19 fast-track regime, a bill was presented, there were 17 projects listed on the schedule, and those projects got referred to a fast-track consenting expert panel.
Is he aware?
Just give yourself a minute while the House composes itself.
Can you advise me whether the House is composed enough?
Sorry?
Can you advise me whether the House is composed enough?
Well, actually, wrong choice of words. It's never likely to happen, but carry on anyway.
Can he confirm that one of the key differences from previous fast-track legislation is that the ultimate decision to approve or decline projects will now sit with ministers rather than with independent experts?
Excellent. Yes, that's a key design choice of the regime. We're proud of it. We're determined to cut through the red tape holding this country back and get on with building things this country needs.
Is he aware that rushing legislation with such extraordinary executive powers through Parliament under urgency with little public scrutiny...
Sorry, you can ask that again. How many times do people have to be told to be quiet while questions are being asked before some people spend quite a bit of time out of the house?
Let me count the ways.
That's not helpful, Mr. Sure, you know that. But anyway.
Is he aware that rushing legislation with such extraordinary executive powers through Parliament under urgency with little public scrutiny creates a risk that any of the projects that are approved as a result of this bill could find themselves subject to future scrutiny, which could include the loss of the consent, possibly without compensation?
Well, firstly, a couple of points to make there. Firstly, the bill's not being rushed through Parliament. The bill is being read a first time this afternoon, and if it meets with the House's approval, it will be sent to a select committee for consideration. It will go to the Environment Committee. I've got full confidence in the chair of the Environment Committee, and actually the Environment Committee to do a good job. There will be a full public submission process. Prior to the bill being introduced into the Parliament, there has been extensive consultation on the design parameters of the bill. There's been extensive engagement with iwi and Maori groups. I've been meeting with them regularly over the last few weeks alongside Minister Potaka. The simple reality is this will be one of the most well-consulted on bills and regimes in recent history. To the member's second point, in throwing around language around cancellation of consents without compensation, I would just say to the member, he needs to be very careful in relation to comments like that. I think all members in Parliament have an obligation to bear in mind sovereign risk to New Zealand and the way in which projects happen.
I just make the point that it is not for the executive to preempt Parliament. There is no bill, and so the suggestion that it will be read this afternoon does preempt Parliament. It's a fine point, but nonetheless one that should be taken into account by ministers.
Question. Can I ask the minister how seriously he takes the threat, malignant as it is, that people who might make under the process passed by this Parliament a legal application for permit should be threatened that when the government changes, they will be not compensated for the construction that was allowed and permitted in the first place?
I think the acting Prime Minister makes a good point, and I just repeat what I said before, which is that I think members generally need to be careful when it comes to threatening things like the leader of the Green Party threatened in his supplementary question.
That brings close to oral questions.